From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Religion and warfare. Does God choose sides? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The Pentagon and a Senate committee are investigating the Fort Hood shootings and the extent of Islamic radicalism in the military. Others warn about the growing presence of evangelical Christians who proselytize soldiers and promote the idea of holy war. Critics concede evangelicals don't advocate killing, but contend that they undermine military morale and send the wrong message in Muslim countries. We'll talk about the separation of church and state, freedom of speech, and the impact of religious fundamentalism on national security. On Reporter's Notebook later on, Oprah Winfrey calls it quits at the same time she plans for the future. First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To The Point. The Fort Hood shootings have raised disturbing questions about Islamic radicalism in the U.S. military. What about evangelical Christianity? Does it pose its own kind of dangers, especially with U.S. troops on the battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan? On Reporter's Notebook, Oprah Winfrey will be leaving daytime TV, but she's not going away. We'll hear about the impact on broadcast TV now and cable TV in the future. First, this news update. The European Union has selected its first full-time president, and it's not Tony Blair or anyone else who might give the EU a higher profile on the world stage. David Rennie is EU correspondent for The Economist magazine. And David, good to have you on our program.
Hello.
Why not Tony Blair?
Well, the job that's just been selected is often called the President of Europe, but actually it's a slightly narrower thing. It's the President of the European Council, and in plain English, what that means is when the 27 national leaders of the countries that make up the union, when they meet several times a year to have summits, they want a chairman. And at the moment, that job is done on a kind of rotating basis by different countries, and they figured it made more sense to have a permanent president. And then there were two big schools of thought. One is that that guy should then be the man who calls Obama, who calls Hu Jintao, who calls Medvedev in Moscow, and is really the front man for Europe at the level of heads of state and government. Then there was another school that said, no, that's absolutely not what we want, particularly as the smaller countries of the European Union felt that such a figure would be the kind of the creature of the big guys. They thought that it would basically be someone who answered to the British and the French and the Germans and would ignore the wishes of small countries. So they said, no, let's have a chairman who just sets the agenda, who chairs the meeting, someone much, much more modest. And that's basically the fight that has ended with a very, very modest figure, Herman Van Rompuy, who has been Prime Minister of Belgium, a pretty little country, for less than a year.
What about the foreign policy chief?
Well, that is in some ways even more shocking, because there was always a chance that they would go for a small president of the council. But then the really big job that is created by the new rule book of the European Union that's just been passed, the Lisbon Treaty, was this big foreign policy job. And this is essentially a foreign minister for Europe. And this person is given a lot of money and 7,000 staff and a network of what will effectively be European embassies around the world, and will also answer to the national governments and will chair the meetings of different foreign ministers from the different European countries. So someone with an enormous amount of money and power and access. And they have given this to someone who has no diplomatic experience, a British technocrat, a career Labour politician who has never held elected office, who's been appointed to a series of things like chairing a regional health authority, was then appointed to the House of Lords in Britain, where she became a relatively senior minister but is not a household name. And then for just about a year, she has been the British commissioner in Brussels dealing with trade negotiations. And she has suddenly been catapulted to being, if you like, Hillary Clinton's opposite number for the European Union.
Baroness Catherine Ashton, she says, am I an ego on legs? No, I'm not. Do I want to be seen out there saying everything all the time? No, I don't. So she may be Hillary Clinton's counterpart, but she's apparently not going to play a similar kind of role.
That's right. And I fear that what has basically happened is The lowest common denominator, which is the curse of negotiating with so many countries, has struck again. I mean, in the end, if you ask yourself, why did Catherine Ashton get this job? The truth is that they decided that it should go to someone who is from the center-left, someone who is a Labour Party or a socialist politician. Ideally, it should go to a woman, and it should go to someone from a big country, probably Britain. So the list got very, very narrow, and you end up with someone who really, frankly, although she has her own skills and her competences, and she's a nice enough lady if you meet her, she is, I would say, manifestly unfit for this job. So it's kind of, they do it by elimination. It's painting by numbers rather than ambition. And I think that's what's really shocking to a lot of people, is that when the leaders gathered, it turned out that for all the big rhetoric about Europe taking its place as a global player, a sort of political giant as well as an economic bloc, it turned out they just didn't have the nerve to do it, and they got cold feet, and they appointed a couple of basically unknowns.
On the other hand, there are economic realities, and the EU is certainly a powerful entity. Is it possible that these people could, with the support particularly of the smaller countries, be able to rally everybody else around?
Well, I think when it comes to kind of the day-to-day business, I'm sure it will be fine. I'm sure that when it comes to perhaps looking at a free trade agreement with the United States, or when it comes to long, slow-moving negotiations on things like climate change, you know, I'm sure the European Union will continue to be a big player. But there was a school of thought, and this includes my own news magazine, The Economist, that said the world is getting very complicated. You have these very, very big players emerging, like China, like the Indians, like Brazil. You have the United States remains a big player on the block. Is the European Union ready to kind of take its place in this age of continents, if you like? I mean, if there's a crisis, imagine a crisis where it looks like perhaps Israel feels it has to bomb Iran, and there's a very limited window for Europe to put up sanctions which are infinitely tougher than anything we've offered before, which could just about stop Israel from bombing Iran. I mean, that's a scenario you hear from diplomats in Brussels. If you had someone like Tony Blair, someone with that level of access, someone with the cell phone numbers of these big leaders, you can wake them up in the middle of the night, maybe he could put together a deal in 24 hours and say, believe me, Europe is on the way, we're going to put these sanctions together, talk to the Israelis, I'm going to talk to the Chinese if you call the Russians. Catherine Ashton, with the best will in the world, is not going to do that.
David Rennie with The Economist, many thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, religion and warfare. Does God choose sides? On To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Alney back with To The Point. The Senate committee is conducting a high-profile investigation into the Fort Hood shootings, and the Pentagon is investigating the extent of Islamic radicalism in the military. Meantime, another kind of religious fundamentalism is widespread and not just condoned, but encouraged by at least some senior officers. It is evangelical Christianity. Jeffrey Charlotte is a contributing editor to Harper's Magazine and author of The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. Jeffrey Charlotte, good to have you on our program.
Hi, good to be here.
How concerned are you about what you call the secret fundamentalism at the heart of American power?
I guess on the cautious side, it's been there for a long time. I mean, the group that I write about and The Family has been around for 70 years, the oldest, most influential Christian right organization in the United States. On the more alarming side is the real rapid growth of this this approach to the conflation of religion and politics, religion and American nationalism, that has really taken off within the military. So on the one hand, it's part of the American political DNA. On the other, it's becoming part of the military mission, and that's something new and frightening.
You wrote an article in Harper's Magazine called Jesus Killed Muhammad, The Crusade for a Christian Military. Where'd you get that title?
Well, it comes from a... comes from the United States Military Army Special Forces, actually. I opened the article with a story of Samara. An Easter Sunday in Samara, Army chaplain comes around to a Special Forces compound, shows the troops a copy of Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ to prepare them for this Easter Sunday in a Muslim land. And that day, the compound came under siege, and it was the bright idea of somebody to take a Bradley fighting vehicle, and a Bradley fighting vehicle is, in effect, sort of a fast-moving tank. a significant firepower. And paint on the side in giant red Arabic letters, and they had the translator do it for them, Jesus killed Muhammad. And then they rolled this Bradley fighting vehicle out in the street. I spoke to the young lieutenant who drove it. He told me that as he drove this tank, blazing with this provocative message, the interpreter for the group was up on the rooftop yelling through a bullhorn in Arabic, Jesus killed Muhammad, Muhammad was a pedophile, and so on. And then the special forces would respond and with extreme force to anyone who kind of answered back. He was doing the same thing as he drove down the street. And as he explained to me, he demolished what amounted to nearly a residential block of Samarra. I asked him if he was concerned, if he had any, you know, concerns about this. And what I meant was he concerned about killing innocent civilians? He interpreted the question differently. He said, no, because I was spiritually armored by my viewing of the Passion of the Christ. That lieutenant, since then, has been promoted to captain.
When you say you asked him or had in your mind the killing of innocent civilians, did, in fact, innocent civilians die as a result of what was being done?
Well, we'll never know for sure, but almost unquestionably. I mean, even by his own... essentially, what they're doing is the compound was under attack by insurgents. So to sort of pull energy away from the siege, they came up with a strategy of driving a Bradley through the streets. And that's a perfectly legitimate strategy. And I spoke to a lot of the troops who were there at that moment, and they all saw that as legitimate. Adding this to it, though, as you know, even military officers have spoken to since, what you do is that's a little bit as if you decided to take an LAPD police cruiser and drive it through South Central with a noose hanging out the window. And then anyone who throws a rock, you open up with full firepower. That's what happened in Samarra. They made insurgents out of normal citizens who weren't inclined to get out into the battle, into the streets. And then they see this tank rolling down a residential street saying, Jesus killed Muhammad. He opened up with this massive firepower on residential house after residential house after residential house. That kind of firepower is enough. It goes through the front door. It also goes through the back door. It blows out the whole room, anyone in that room. So, yeah, it's a safe bet that innocent civilians were killed.
Jeffrey Charlotte, again, author of The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power, and a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. Dr. James Hutchins is retired as a U.S. Army chaplain. He was formerly deputy chief of chaplains, earned a Purple Heart in Vietnam, retired with the rank of brigadier general, worked in the Pentagon during the first Gulf War. He currently is a Christian Zionist pastor with the Presbyterian Church in America. Dr. Hutchins, thank you very much for being on our program.
Thank you. My pleasure.
What is your reaction to the concern of Jeffrey Charlotte about what he says is the rapid growth of the conflation of religion and politics, religion and nationalism, leading to the incident that he outlined a moment ago?
Well, I think there's no question but what the evangelical church especially is growing in this country. As to its impact and influence, I think that's questionable. I think the latest election would be an indicator that it doesn't have that much influence. But I think it's growing, and I think as far as chaplains are concerned in the military, there was a time where quotas were established based upon the number of religious adherents. Say the Lutherans had so many people in the country, and there were so many Lutherans that would come into the military on that basis, Episcopalians, Catholics, and so on. But the liberal denominations primarily are not interested in serving in the military, number one, and secondly, as chaplains. So the military has had to open it up for the best qualified. And if you meet the qualifications, especially the educational qualifications of the chaplaincy, and you have a legitimate endorsing agent from a faith group, a recognized faith group, then a chaplain can be can apply for this. Now, as to this incident that the first speaker referred to, I really don't have any comment on that. I think that they're spiritually minded, religious minded officers in the military, and from my experience, that's been a very good and positive influence. But as far as a chaplain is concerned, a chaplain is there ultimately in the military by Supreme Court decision to minister to the dying, the wounded in combat. And that's what he is there for. And it's not, he's not there to question somebody else's religion and to serve just those who abide by his religion. I think, you know, if a kid's laying there with a sucking chest wound crying, "God, help me," I don't go to him and say, "What's your religion, son? I need to know that before I can minister to you."
You don't want to comment on the incident that was reported by Jeffrey Charlotte, but is there a risk of excess on the part of people who are proselytized and encouraged in fundamentalist thinking?
Oh, I'm sure there are excesses of it, but there are likewise excesses of political correctness that would stifle this kind of thing as well. And out of fear and intimidation or threat of a suit would stop it. But my experience in the military was not that. There was an openness there. There's a recognition that there was a place for chaplains. There's a place for religious officers to manifest their religion. I don't know about this case here. I mean, I have no knowledge of it as to respond to it, but. Yeah, there are excesses. I'm sure there are excesses. There are excesses in every religion. There are excesses among atheists. So, I think that's the exception rather than the rule.
But who are the politically correct who might, as you say, try to stop this by fear or intimidation or threat of a lawsuit?
I think that exists in the military today. Chief of Staff of the Army, General Casey, his first response to what took place in Fort Hood was, we must be absolutely certain that there's no retaliation against other Muslim members of the military. That should not be his first response, in my view. His first response should be concern for the families, number one, and secondly, for security of all people on military posts. That should be one of the most secure places on the face of the planet.
On the other hand, is it wrong to be concerned about the other Muslims who might be in the military and their friends, associates, and families?
Yeah, that's one of many concerns. That's not the top concern, in my view.
What about your own view with respect to the religions that we've talked about, Islam on the one hand, Christianity on the other? Do you feel that God is your God is better than their God, that that we are, in to some extent at least, engaged in a holy war?
Oh, there's no question but what we're engaged in a religious war. I mean, the Islamic jihadists consider it that. We may not consider it that. We call it a war on terror. Terror is a tactic. But we are fighting against Islamic jihadists. We don't want to say that, and political correctness precludes our saying that. I say our saying that, our leadership, our president, and even the military. This is not a war on terror. This is a war on Islamic jihadists, and they know it, and they'll say it as that. We just refuse to say it.
Dr. James Hutchins, again, retired Brigadier General, chaplain, and former Deputy Chief of Chaplains, earned a Purple Heart once again in Vietnam. Mikey Weinstein is president and founder of the Military Religious Freedom Foundation. He's a former White House counsel. That was during the Reagan administration, former general counsel to Ross Perot. He's author of With God on Our Side, One Man's War Against an Evangelical Coup in America's Military. Mikey Weinstein, good to have you on our program.
Hi, yes. Actually, it's Mikey.
Mikey, I beg your pardon. Your response to what we heard from Chaplain Hutchins, that this is a question of religious freedom and freedom of speech.
I'm so angry right now what he said that I'm trying to remember that this stands for NPR, doesn't necessarily stand for National Polite Radio. First of all, I want to say to Dr. Hutchins, thank you for your service to our country, sir. I know you've been in combat. I know you won the Purple Heart. That I appreciate, and I respect you very much for that. To make some of the statements that you made is an outrage as far as I'm concerned. Our foundation represents well over 15,000 active duty United States Marines, sailors, soldiers, and airmen. 96% of our clients are Protestants and Catholics, so they're just being told they're not Christian enough. We also, the one place we might have shared something, Dr. Hutchins, would be the fact that we also were furious at what General Casey said. His first response should not have been that he was worried about some blowback to Muslims. His first response should have been an order that there would be no blowback. He's not, you know, he's not the CEO of KFC. He's a four-star general, and he should have made it clear there'd be a zero-tolerance policy for any retaliation or retribution against anyone in the military. This isn't, oh, I'm not sure, I guess there's some excesses everywhere. We don't have atheists, sir. We don't have Buddhists. We don't have mainline Protestants and Catholics or Jews or Hindus. that are forcing their religious faith on helpless subordinates. I was in the military for 14 years. I'm an Air Force Academy graduate. Three of my children are. My brother and brother-in-law went there. My father went to Annapolis. I come from a conservative Republican military family. And I can tell you that I don't know how long you've been out, but things have changed since the service that you gratefully gave to our country. Right now, about 84% of the chaplaincy at least is of a significant evangelical base, but that's just the chaplaincy. At least they're just staff officers. We're not calling this a problem, and we're not calling this a challenge or an issue at all, Warren. We call this a national security threat internally to our country, every bit as much as what we're facing externally by a resurgent Taliban and al-Qaeda. Yes, they view it as a religious war, but we should never paint all of Islam with the brush of Wahhabist, fundamentalist, Sharia-imposing monsters that we're correctly fighting. And I would lastly say to Dr. Hutchins, since you asked me, Warren, please remember, sir, that we did defeat fascists like Hitler, Tojo, and Mussolini in merely 44 months in World War II without having become fascists like them. We're way past 44 months now. And what our foundation says is that we basically have a fundamentalist Christian parachurch military corporate proselytizing complex inside of it. That's how bad it is. Thank you very much.
What do you mean by a national security threat?
Well, I think we just saw that. I mean, we are doing by appearing, and you heard Mr. Charlotte talk about Jesus killed Muhammad. We have thousands of stories like this. This is why we're currently, I guess basically Dr. Hutchins was describing me when he talked about fear and intimidation going into court. We're currently suing the Pentagon in federal district court on this exact point in Kansas City, Kansas, for what we call the four Ps, a pervasive and pernicious pattern and practice of essentially unconstitutional rape of the religious liberties of our members of the military. Look, when you sit there and you make it very clear that in the minds of the people we're fighting that we look like the 10th incarnation of the Crusades. I mean, just I know we're about to have somebody on from West Point. We just 17 hours before the shootings at Fort Hood, we had a cadet at West Point reach out to us on behalf of 40 others at West Point, staff and cadets, because they were infuriated by the fact that one of the cadet companies is called the Crusaders. It's company C1. And at their football games and basketball games, they dress up a cadet in an 11th century Crusaders outfit complete with shield and sword running up and down the sidelines. We are emboldening the enemy and encouraging already pissed off and angry young Islamic men and women in Morocco, Libya, Egypt, Syria, Jordan to want to come and join the fight against us. That's why, sir.
Again, Mikey Weinstein is the president and founder of the Military Religious Freedom Foundation. Dr. Hutchins, we need to go to a break in just a minute, and so I won't you won't have time to respond as fully as I'm sure you want to what we just heard. But what's your initial reaction?
Well, this is the, as I mentioned, this is the attempt to bring about political correctness according to one person's interpretation of it by instituting fear and intimidation. And as Mikey Weinstein has said, he'll sue you if you don't like what you're doing.
James Hutchins, again, former chaplain, deputy chief of chaplains, who earned a Purple Heart in Vietnam. We're going to come back and continue this conversation with our current guests and others as well, as was just mentioned. On Reporter's Notebook, we'll talk about Oprah Winfrey. She's calling it quits. At the same time, she plans for the future. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Once again, talking about religion in the military. Mikey Weinstein with the Military Religious Freedom Foundation just said that some 96% of the people that he has are in his organization, 15,000 Marines, sailors, and airmen who are 96% Protestant and Catholic, say they've been intimidated by proselytizers from the religious right who say they are not Christian enough. Let me go back to Dr. Hutchins on that particular point, Doctor. Is that something that goes beyond political correctness? Is that something that you ought to be concerned about?
I would question that, frankly. I would question that. I just don't think that's the people against religion in the military amounts to that kind of a number at all. I would question it.
What about the statement that we ought not condemn all of Islam because of what some jihadists do? Is there
I agree with that. There are members of Islam that are not jihadists, but the jihadists control it. They're the primary voice at this point. I mean, there are very few voices that are coming out against Islamic jihadism among Muslims, and for fear of their own well-being. That's established. I mean, an excellent DVD that I saw recently is The Third Jihad, that it was put together by a Muslim doctor who sees what's happening in this country and in the attempt to impose Sharia law. There are many moderate Muslims, no question about it, but they're not in control of their religion.
Both Mikey Weinstein and Jeffrey Charlotte said that they think that what's happening here is that insurgents are being made out of Muslims that otherwise would not be insurgents because of the way that the military is behaving, the kinds of things that are being said, the idea that there is a unit at West Point called the Crusaders. What's your response to that?
The fastest growing part of Islam today, as I understand it, is in prisons. And it's largely among African Americans. They're being recruited and won to that faith there. I don't know what's going on as far as proselyting of Muslims. I'm an evangelical, and I operate under the Great Commission, as my church has endorsed me to do. And the Great Commission is to go into all the world and preach the gospel. I don't apologize for that. So that may be the case with evangelicals that are in leadership positions within the military. It is in politics as well. But our Constitution guarantees that, a freedom of religion and a freedom of speech.
Are you, though, really an expert on Islam?
No, I'm not an expert on Islam. But I know enough about it to know that the Islamic jihadists are the moving force behind worldwide Islam today, wherever you go.
We don't have a Muslim speaker on our program today, but let me go back to Jeffrey Charlotte with Harper's Magazine. You've looked into these issues at some depth. What do you say to that statement?
The idea that
that the jihadists are leading the Islamic religion at this point worldwide.
I think, I mean, that's demographically just absurd. And when we look at, the number one Islamic nation in the world is Indonesia, which isn't anything but a jihadist state. That's the biggest population-wise by far. And in fact, they just rejected an even mildly conservative Islamist candidate in favor of a secular candidate. So this idea that that's the leading force of Islam is just wrong. And to speak up to Dr. Hutton's point about the recruitment, as he put it, of Islam in the prisons, he's correct that the Americanized Nation of Islam, which is not Al-Qaeda by a long shot, is popular in the prisons. But it doesn't have anywhere near the access that Chuck Colson's Christian Right, Hard Right Fundamentalist Ministry Prison Fellowship does, which has been given control of prisons by U.S. government. And again, Dr. Hutchins and I agree on one thing. I'm sure Mikey Weinstein's in on this too, the free exercise of religion. That's a essential part of American freedoms. It's the free exercise clause in the First Amendment. It's preceded by the Establishment Clause, which says that Congress can't make it, and government cannot establish religion. The government must remain neutral on religion. So no military, an elected politician, he can say whatever he wants, and the people can decide to vote for him or not. But a military leader really can't, because there is that establishment protection. That's the protection that allows everybody, not just Dr. Hutchinson's co-religionists, but everybody to have freedom of religion within the U.S. Armed Forces and within society in general.
Dr. Hutchins, is there an effort, do you think, by evangelicals to establish themselves as the religion of the military?
No, I don't. I'm not aware of any movement, organized movement, that is that. There may be many in leadership in the military that are evangelical Christians, but there is no organized movement to make evangelical Christianity the religion of the military.
Mikey Weinstein, what's your take on that idea?
Right there. Look, Dr. Hutchins, you literally haven't done your homework and don't know what you're talking about. Let me give you, for instance, the Officers Christian Fellowship. There are so many, I don't even know where to begin. Their mantra, which they only changed in January of this year after we beat them up for 3 or 4 years, their express goal right on their website was, we want Christian officers exercising biblical leadership to raise up a godly military. I'm not done. There are three express purposes. Number one, we want to see a spiritually transformed United States military. Number two, with ambassadors for Christ in uniform. Number three, empowered by the Holy Spirit. Lastly, their key Bible study that they force on their subordinates states, we will not allow the opposition, all of which is spearheaded by Satan, to prevent us from regaining territory for our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ in the U.S. military. There are thousands of members of the Officers Christian Fellowship. In fact, at West Point, Bob Caslin, who was the star of the famous Christian Embassy video found by Jeff Charlotte in one of his prior stories, I believe it was Jeff for Harper's, who went on, who's now, I think, commands the 25th Infantry Division at Schofield Barracks in Hawaii, has been the past president, if he's not currently the president,
okay,
of the Officers Christian Fellowship.
Let me go back to Dr. Hutchins. Is that appropriate in the military?
I don't know what the membership of the Fellowship of Christian officers is. I don't know what the membership is, but sure, it is. It's legitimate. I mean, there are many organizations that have goals and achievements that they want to make. What's wrong with that? This is freedom of religion, and you have freedom of religion in the military. And the free exercise of religion has been greatly downplayed, the first part, the Establishment Clause. The Establishment Clause is taking great precedent over anything else, almost to the exclusion in many cases of the Free Exercise Clause.
Let me turn to another student of these matters, Jacqueline Witt, who is an assistant professor of military history at West Point. She has studied the role of military chaplains during the Vietnam War and after that. And Professor Witt, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to this conversation. Put it in perspective from your point of view.
It's terribly interesting. I am a historian by training, and so I think when I think about the nature of the relationship between religion and the state and the military in particular, I think it's particularly important to understand some of the historical context that we're talking about, namely that the relationship changes over time, that what the founders may have wanted, may have intended, was in a different time and a different place than what we have now. And so understanding especially the relationship between the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause in the First Amendment is an exercise in understanding social and cultural changes, and it is an exercise in understanding that there is not a single way that has been interpreted legally or in sort of pop culture. And then within the military, we have, sort of broad trends, I think, of rising evangelical influence in the military, especially after the Vietnam War. And, again, that very, very closely mirrors the rise of what we call the religious right in American religion as a whole. And so these are absolutely relevant and current things to be talking about, but I think they must be put into a broad historical perspective in order for us to really understand them.
In what way are they comparable and what way are they different to what is referred to as Islamic extremism?
Well, I think one thing is definitionally we talk about fundamentalist religion being on in some ways the margins or the fringes of more mainstream, more mainline religion. So within the broad subset of evangelical Christians, many of whom would identify as such, there are fundamentalist Christians who have a certain set of theological and doctrinal beliefs, and they do tend toward more extreme positions. I think one of the things that characterizes evangelical Christianity as a whole is the goal to convert non-believers. And so if conversion is the ultimate goal, then in one way, violence resulting in the death of those non-believers makes little sense. And I do think that is a difference and an important one between fundamentalist or very conservative evangelical Christianity and Islamic fundamentalism as we see in the idea of jihad and things like that. So when we talk about the end state, what evangelical Christians are promoting tends not toward violence, but does tend toward very aggressive proselytization and conversion of people who do not believe like they do.
What about violence toward Muslims in Muslim countries, particularly? Is there a danger, as we heard described earlier by Jeffrey Charlotte, that there will be violence against people who appear not to be possible to convert?
Sure. I think part of the challenge for the American military in going into a culture that is very, very different from mainstream American culture is understanding the lines and the use of force and when that's appropriate and when it's not and what context it's used in. And so I think when we see evidence of using religious language, using religious ideas, particularly in combat against people of another religious faith, I do think there are serious questions to be asked. At the same time, we're learning more and more just how important the command climate is. That there are regulations in the military. There are rules that are in place and have been in place for a long time to prevent just that sort of thing. And if those can be enforced, I think there's a reasonable expectation that problem can be a lid put on that.
Are there concerns about the sort of issues raised on this program by Mikey Weinstein of the Military Religious Freedom Foundation? Is this something that's being discussed at West Point and elsewhere in the military?
You know, I spend an awful lot of time in my office in the history department and think a lot about the past. But I do know there are people who talk about these things, and there are certainly people who are wanting to work through some of the issues that Mikey raised, but it's not something that I am involved in or can really comment on.
Okay. Jacqueline Witt, once again, Assistant Professor of Military History at West Point, student of the role of military chaplains during Vietnam and after that. We have just a little bit of time left, but I want to introduce a final guest for our program, Gene Schrodel, who is a chair of the Department of Politics and Policy at the Claremont Graduate School in California. She's co-editor of the newly published two-volume study of Evangelicals and Democracy in America. It's a broader look than just in the military, but it's good to have you on our program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, and I have thoroughly enjoyed listening to your other guests. It's been great.
Well, let me ask you the same kind of question I asked Jacqueline Witt, which is to put it in the context of your research and where you think things are going.
Okay. First, I think it is important that all of us, whether you are on the left, the right, in between, whatever religious faith or non-faith that you have, I think it's really important that all of us not demonize any group, whether it's the evangelicals in mass or Muslims in mass. And I've done work on evangelicals, so a couple points I think are worth noting. First is, among self-identified white evangelicals, okay, the group that is generally thought of as engaging in these behaviors in the military, in that group, in the general populace, only 1 out of 5 of white self-identified evangelicals would say that they identify with the religious right. So even among the evangelical group that is talked about most broadly as being the bulwark of the religious right or the rise of conservative Protestantism, most of those people are not associated with what we tend to think of as the religious right. And is this probably a higher proportion in the military? I haven't done work on the military. My hunch is, given that you are putting your life on the line when you are in the military, I strongly suspect that's the case. But I think it's important that we keep in mind the difference between the broad community and individuals, possibly a relatively small portion, who engage in behaviors that are inappropriate, excessive, bad, whatever term you wish to use. So I think that's really important.
What about other religious people in the military and the concerns of Mikey Weinstein that they don't get a chance to or that they feel under siege, I think, and that they aren't Christian enough? What did you find about the feelings of evangelicals toward other Christians?
Actually, it's quite interesting. And again, we're talking about broader society rather than the military. In terms of which groups they feel close to, evangelical Protestants tend to feel actually quite close to Jews during this particular point in time. They are moderately close to Catholics. The group that, interestingly, that they've identified as not being particularly close to in terms of feeling comfortable with is Mormons, another group that is overrepresented in the U.S. military and who shares many of the socially conservative views that we tend to associate with evangelical Protestants.
Why do you think it is that evangelical Christianity is particularly attractive to soldiers?
Well, I think you need to first begin with thinking about what groups tend to enlist in the military. I mean, right now, the military, depending which branch, is, I think the, if I remember correctly, the data is the Coast Guard is about 15% female. It's the highest portion female. My data may be off. Remember, these are people who are experts on the military. But it's mostly young males, okay, not females. And generally speaking, it's young men who have fewer opportunities. When we're talking particularly about the enlisted ranks, maybe they are lower income. The chances of the military offers upward mobility. But when we are talking about this group, we know that evangelical Christianity is more associated with people from lower SES, which is not to say that they're not high SES people, but it's historically drawn from working class, particularly working class whites, the sort of Protestant evangelical impetus. And interestingly, no one has been talking today, at least in the part that I've heard, about African Americans. I mean, African Americans are heavily evangelical, but in terms of their politics, are quite different in terms of their voting behavior than are white evangelicals. And they're overwhelmingly Democratic, even though they hold a socially conservative positions that tend to be connected with the Republican Party. So, and again, it's the, let's keep in mind not painting with a broad brush. And evangelicals are not all white. They're not all conservative.
We're going to leave it at that, again, with Gene Schrodel, who is professor at the Claremont Graduate School and whose recent publication, of which he is co-editor, is a two-volume study of evangelicals and democracy in America. Thanks to you, Professor. Thanks to all of our other guests as well. Jacqueline Witt, also professor of military history at West Point. Mikey Weinstein, who is president and founder of the Military Religious Freedom Foundation. Dr. James Hutchins, retired U.S. Army chaplain, a former deputy chief of chaplains, now a Christian Zionist pastor with the Presbyterian Church in America, and Jeffrey Charlotte, author of The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power, and contributing editor to Harper's Magazine. Many thanks to all of you for being with us today. Nobody was surprised today when Oprah Winfrey announced that her daytime TV talk show will come to an end about 2 years from now. What will that mean for the broadcast landscape and for cable TV? More in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To The Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To The Point.
Werman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To The Point. Here's Oprah Winfrey explaining today why next season, number 25, will be the last for The Oprah Winfrey Show.
So here we are, halfway through the season 24, and it still means as much to me to spend an hour every day with you as it did back in 1986. So why walk away and make next season the last? Here is the real reason. I love this show. This show has been my life. And I love it enough to know when it's time to say goodbye.
Oprah Winfrey. Kim Masters is columnist for the DailyBeast.com and host of The Business, produced by KCRW, which co-produces To the Point, the program you are listening to. Kim Masters, good to have you back on our program.
Nice to be here.
So she may be quitting this show, but she is not going away.
No, she's going to go to this the Oprah Winfrey Network, which is a joint venture with Discovery, and which was announced last year and has not launched. It was supposed to launch this year, and it's kind of looked like a mess. So she talked about the real reason she's leaving. I think the real reason she may be leaving is that the folks at Discovery said, hey, get over here and work on this or forget it. And she decided maybe she should do that.
What does this mean about broadcasting? What does this mean about cable TV?
Well, broadcasting, you know, has been drifting downward. The audience is fragmenting. This is a big pillar to fall. Oprah Winfrey is the queen of the daytime talk show. She far exceeds the ratings of any of her rivals. And so it's a big loss for them. On the other hand, you know, she has sold her show to TV stations, particularly ABC stations in major markets. They've paid very, very high fees to air her show. And it's become very expensive at a time when those independent television stations and owned television stations, all of them are struggling. The economy has just battered them. So, you know, it's a mixed thing for the stations, but it provided a very strong lead into their local news, which is absolutely key to them. So they'll save some money, but they may lose more audience, which will make it harder to charge for ads. So, you know, it's not a great thing for the broadcast world. Now, in the cable world, you know, it's a question of a lot of people are invoking Howard Stern. Can Oprah Winfrey move over with some kind of show on cable and command the kind of audiences that she gets in broadcast? Because broadcast is hurting, but it's still the greatest aggregator of eyeballs. It's not dead. It's far from dead at this point.
You mentioned, let's go just back to broadcasting briefly, the ABC stations are the ones that carry the show, but CBS actually distributes her program. Is that right?
Yes, CBS gets a percentage of a lot of money. A source of mine estimating it at about $40 million plus a year as a fee for distributing her show. And for them, it's just a pure, you know, it's a loss. I mean, they're saying, well, yes, we still have all these other top 10 shows that we distribute, but that's fine. None of them is the Oprah Winfrey show.
Is this a kind of endorsement of cable television by somebody whose name everybody in the world knows? And is that important from a business and economic standpoint?
I think it will definitely be perceived that way. You know, we're at a point of tremendous uncertainty across the board in the entertainment business. Movies, television, everybody's trying to figure out what will work and how to survive. So a big name like Oprah Winfrey going there is a big thing for cable. Now, broadcasting a whole cable network is a different challenge from putting on a very, very successful show every day. So it remains to be seen, you know, what she can do with that space and whether the impact will be what Discovery certainly hopes it will be.
How has her program been different from other programs on daytime TV?
You know, she just has the secret sauce. She has this mixture of sort of aspiration and encouragement and telling you what to read and telling you to write in your diary and bringing on, you know, people, unfortunately, like Dr. Phil. That's my little editorial comment there. And she has created this. People have grown up with her. She's going to have been on the air for 25 years. So she has a space that no one else can occupy. No one will succeed her. I mean, somebody like Ellen DeGeneres does fine, but she does not get near. I'm sure she's happy to have less competition, but she does not have Oprah Winfrey numbers.
Ellen DeGeneres says she will always be Oprah will always be the queen of daytime television. She deserves to rest.
Well, she's not going to rest. I think Ellen will probably wish she would rest, but I think she's perfectly glad to have her off of the broadcast, out of the broadcast arena. But she will. I think she's right. She will always be the queen of daytime talk.
Will this mean, though, are you suggesting that there will be cable competition with broadcasting in daytime? And is Oprah Winfrey likely to have her own show on her own cable network?
Well, she hasn't told us what she's going to do yet. You know, she's kept this very much mum. So initially she said, I'm going to move my talk show over to this Oprah Winfrey network. She's now apparently saying, no, not really. But, you know, you kind of wonder, is it possible that she's going to have her own network and not have a show? And, you know, how different could it be? I mean, you sort of had Jay Leno go from 11:35 on NBC to 10, and it was supposed to be really, really different. And now we've seen the product, and, you know, I don't know about you, Warren, but but to me it just doesn't look that different. So can Oprah Winfrey having a show, I assume that she'll talk, and I don't know, maybe she'll do a completely different format, but I can't imagine she's not going to have a show and some kind of version of herself on there.
Can't help asking this question. Oprah Winfrey did a bit of a softball interview with Sarah Palin on the occasion of Sarah Palin's book. What about Sarah Palin?
Oh, please don't make me go there. Who knows what Sarah Palin's aspirations are? So, you know, she certainly hasn't ruled out a run for the White House. So I think it's far too soon to say. And I don't think Sarah Palin could ever be Oprah Winfrey, honestly, because I think Sarah Palin is an incredibly divisive figure, and Oprah has cut across all kinds of groups and, you know, economic and social groups. So Oprah is a unifier. Sarah seems to me to be more of a divider.
Kim Masters, host of The Business, produced by KCRW, columnist for The Daily Beast. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
Producers of To the Point are Frances Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Andrea Brody, Katie Cooper, Sonia Geis, and Gary Scott. Our technical director is Mike Newport. Managing producer, Cameron Radziner. Special thanks to Julia Fluch. Thanks to the John Coltrane family. Our email address is tothepoint@kcrw.com, or you can share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/tothepoint. I'm Marvin Almy. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.